Hello, listeners. You're listening to FlixWise Canada. I'm excited for this episode because we're going to be talking about one of my favorite films, Khrushchev, My Car, with an exclamation point. And joining me for this discussion, there's Peter Rinaldi, head of the Fantastic Back to One podcast. Hi, Peter.
Hi. So excited to be here.
And also joining us is M. Tumay Gant, actor, filmmaker, teacher. Hi, M. Tumay.
How y'all doing?
Glad to have you. Thanks for coming on.
Excellent to be here, man. I'm very excited to talk about this movie.
Same. I feel like this is a perfect film to jump into. It's Alexa Garman's 1998 film, which is, depending on who you ask, maybe the final word on Stalinism. It's about a Jewish doctor, a brain surgeon named Yuri Klensky, General Klensky, who gets caught up in the doctor's plot, which people listening may not know, but I think in some ways it's actually maybe better to go into the film without fully knowing and just to kind of experience it firsthand rather than getting all your context up front.
Yeah.
But I don't know. This is the sort of film where I think you can have different reactions to it each time, different impressions. So I'm a little bit curious how each of you felt watching it for the first time.
Hmm.
Oh,
and, first time, you know, if yeah. you've seen it subsequent times, how that's maybe changed over time or deferred.
You know, I had heard of Trial on the Road, but I had never seen it. And I saw Hard to Be a God, I think not too long after it came out, and I was totally floored. I was like, this is the wildest movie I've ever seen in my life. Who is this yes. guy? I was like, who is this guy? I was like, why has he been hidden from me? You know, it
feels I felt the same way. Like, yeah. Where did this come from? Like, there are other movies like this?
This
like,
exists.
How did you get to this? Yes.
And and then I remember, I think Filmstruck had Trial on the Road for a while, and then they took it off. And I had to go find it, and I watched that. But this Khrushchev, My Car had, like, I kept looking at it. I was like, what is this movie? I'm going to have to check this out at some point. And, you know, I first saw it when they did – I wanted to see it at New York – I wanted to see it at New York Film Festival, but I wasn't able to. But Metrograph here in New York City was playing it, and I went and saw it. And I have to say, it disarms you – immediately. You have to come up to it. And I actually really like that about when cinema does that. It's like, all right, we're going in a certain way, we're going to move a certain way, and this is how you're going to deal with it. And you're going to yeah. have to deal with it in this way. And I really just respect that. And but also, I mean, it's able to do that because it's such great technical cinema. It also has a lot of feeling. It's funny. It's zany. It's yes. scary. It's dark. So it gives you all of these things. So you're willing to yeah. go with it. Even as it went in, even if you don't understand specific things. And that's where I was, you know, it's a 2.5 hour movie and I went and saw it. And I was like, you know what? I'm fine actually not understanding a moment because I'm feeling something. I'm getting an yeah. experience. Right. Yeah. And then I realized the experience is to be a bit confused. It is to be it's a yes. confusing period. Nothing makes sense. Things just happen. People come out of trucks that look like wood, you know, like carrying wood. Like, what is this? That's what's happening. So I was just like, you know what? I'm going with this. And I remember when the final frame hits, I realized I had a profound experience. And I watched it again, you know, preparing for this podcast, and I had the same feeling. I think I understood a little bit more, or I felt differently, but I realized I don't think it's really about any kind of intellectual understanding, at least for me, but it's about kind of feeling what it is to be in a period where everything is changing and nothing really makes sense to you. And the anxiety, when you have anxiety, there's no way you can really have sense. Anxiety yeah. doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
it's illogical, you know?
Yes. I think that's 100% correct. Like, the feeling of it is key. And I think, you know, a different filmmaker would have sort of explained to you what you're about to see.
Right.
Like, for the recent Blu-ray release, I noticed there's this edition of, like, a little scrolling text that the French distributor added to try to make it less confusing for people. But I think that's kind of actually a hindrance, you know. I think
yeah
for people in that situation, like, you know, nobody told you what was happening. Like, the explanation would come after the fact. Right. You'd be sent off to the gulag, and then they would say, oh, this was the plot, and this is the sort of made-up thing around it. And, like, I think something about these really strong juxtapositions, the light and the dark, and the kind of high to low to high to low, gives you this sense of a completely unstable society. Like, you know, for somebody to go on basically the, you know, from the upper echelons to being thrown into gulag to being pulled back to, you know, all these different situations. And it, at the same time, it works as such a effective cross-section of Russian society at the time. Like, it, you really just see all these different aspects of it. Peter, I think you saw it before Heart to Be a God even out. So you're the... out of the three of us, you're the first one in on this.
Yeah, I saw it when it originally played at the New York Film Festival in 1998.
Whoa!
Yeah, yeah. And I had been a fanatic of Guillermo's work for like 2 years at that point, because I saw my friend Ivan Lapshin in film school in 1995. And... It blew my mind, but it blew my mind only the second time I saw it. The first time I saw it, I fell asleep in it, but I kept waking up and seeing things like, and I was like, later on, I was just riding my bike somewhere. I was like, wait, that movie I kept falling asleep in. So there's something about that, I went to see it again at another class that wasn't my class. I asked the teacher, can I just come and see this movie? And I was so busy with other things. It's insane that I went to see that, considering what I had to do that week. I remember that. But considering now that I think that might be my favorite movie of all time, My Friend Ivan Lapshin. Mm-hmm. And then it was the Dark Ages. I did not know who this guy was. I didn't know if he made any other movies. I didn't, you know, it's hard to figure out. The one teacher I had who was actually Russian, his name was Michael Brzezinski. I went to him and I said, I just saw this movie, My Friend Ivan Lapshin. I said, but it's not on VHS. I don't know anybody that's even seen it. He's like, I just talked to German on the phone last week. Yeah.
What?
Yeah. And I thought, wow. And he's like, yeah, he's working on a new movie right now. And then I was, and all I wanted at this time was just a VHS of My Friend Ivan Lapshin. That's all I thought. All right, well, can you just tell me where? He's like, it's got to be around. It's got to be around. So anyway, cut to 3 or 4 years later, 1998, when I found out that this film is playing, his new film is playing at the New York Film Festival. I went. It was a packed audience. I was way up in the back. When it got over, there was only like 20 people that stayed around for Guillermo to do on the question and answer. Everybody left. But I remember that Peña, the head of the film festival, introduced it saying that it will be talked about. He actually said this will be the only film, or he said something like this. It was like, of all the films we are playing here, this will be the one that will be talked about 20 years from now. And it is 20 years from now, and I mean, we're talking about it, but I don't know, you know, who else is. But I guess it certainly grew in respect over those years, like you said it would. But when I saw it, I did not. So I think it's important to say, Martin, I want to just read. Martin, you wrote an amazing five-part thing for
articles, like that's how we first met.
For Pink Smoke, I think, right? And
yes.
And the thing that is that you wrote in here, I just want to read it real quick, is it's like each scene is overflowing with visual and auditory information, which can make it difficult to draw out clear linear narrative meanings until looking back with hindsight or upon a repeat viewing. Not that the details are meaningless, but I think in part it's a bit of a trick to keep viewers from ever feeling settled.
I think it is.
You know, I think that's really so true. And I feel so lucky that after that New York Film Festival screening, and then it played in New York like almost every year, like an anthology or somewhere, and I went to see every one. So I saw it like 6 times. In the theaters over the next 10 years, not knowing anything else about anything, not having any context about you know, not filling myself in historically with anything. And I feel like this was a good way to see it because I was never, I never had any way of grasping things, but I was feeling it out each time, you know, and I was loving it more and more each time, but I wasn't necessarily, it wasn't necessarily clearing up as it went on. In fact, this last time I saw it, I think I understand less than I ever did before. And I have no problem with this whatsoever.
Yeah, exactly. That's really true. You know?
Well, I think like German cinema, in some ways it works a lot like music for me. It's like music that you feel very deeply, like the blues or something like that. You sort of,
yeah,
understanding it's kind of beside the fact.
Yes.
You know, you leave with an impression of, or, you know, you sort of get lost in your own thoughts and it kind of leads you in these other directions. And it's like you're not even really meant to unpack certain things, you know. And again, like these details aren't meaningless. Like each one's very thought out and researched, yes, and, you know, added with a lot of care. But I think, you know, the details aren't the point. And part of film criticism in general, it's sort of training you to kind of unpack and interpret these types of details. You know, that's where I think a lot of people kind of get trapped, yes, in this film.
Yes, totally.
Yes.
Like some of the initial responses, I remember reading like what the reviews were for it when it first came out. And even like even some of the Russian reviews, I sort of realized like people weren't that positive on it and were kind of getting hung up on certain things. Like, or I don't know. I remember reading this one review by Jonathan Romney where he compared it to Finnegan's Wake. And I thought like that's really kind of the wrong approach, yeah, to try and,
yeah,
figure
out
what the film is. But yeah.
Yeah, it's weird. I said to someone after I saw it, I said, I feel like there was an opportunity for cinema to kind of move in a certain way and it didn't. And I feel like this film is that.
Yeah.
Is if cinema went in a certain direction that I think might have been better for cinema to a certain degree, I,
yeah,
feel like we would have had more like this. But I think because we're so bent on information as a culture and being able to immediately take information as some kind of confirmer of whatever we're thinking, rather than like using information to create some kind of tapestry, which is what this film does. Because I agree. Like, I'm watching it. I'm never thinking this director does not know what he's talking about, or he does,
yeah,
not know the landscape. I know he has a complete handle over everything he's doing.
Yeah. Yes.
You know, but I'm definitely confused, and I'm definitely, but like we're all confused. If we could figure this thing out, if we could figure out society, how to deal with state governments, how to deal with people watching us, and all these things, we wouldn't have problems. So how the hell are you gonna make a? So how the hell are you gonna make,
yeah,
a movie that seems to understand all these things clearly, and then we're able to walk out of it?
And you know what? What you said before and what you're saying now goes together, because when you said this movie commands, and I don't think you used that word, it commands your, it makes you go on its wavelength.
Yeah.
Those are not the words you used, but but it fits into what you're saying now, because he has a command of his art that isn't it feels like it's not fitting in with any other tradition.
Mm-mm.
And there is influences. Like I wanted to watch Amarcord again. I it's been so long. I wanted to see that again before we talked, and I didn't.
Right.
But I'm not saying he wasn't influenced, but there is something about that idea that he's working on another. His drumbeat is on another thing, and he's just doing it for his in that level, and you have to get into that, you have to go into that level, and then it doesn't matter, like it not making logical sense doesn't matter,
right,
or you're not understanding it, you're in an artistic thing, and it's feeling, and then and it's also you're just in the art of it, because every single there's the mise-en-scene is insane in this. I mean, like,
yeah,
you could just
yeah,
sit in there and live in it. But the thing I'm always annoyed about with that, I can't find, German seems to always be saying he's upset that people don't know what's going on. Like, he's saying, I've heard in interviews saying, like, it's easy. Like I don't. I've heard him say things like, "People should know what's going on. Like, we should know that this guy, because this guy's wearing galoshes and has an umbrella, that he's a certain foreigner." You know?
Right.
I'm like, but to me, especially on this last viewing, it really felt like every single moment. It wasn't just like plot points and narratively. Every single motivation for every single character, almost every single move that everyone makes is not logically, is not making logical sense to the moment.
Right.
You know, and it's like, it's almost like it feels like now, I never felt it before, except this last time, it feels like he's purposefully making every moment not have this logical sense, character-wise, emotionally. And I think this is what I've always responded to and loved.
It feels like there's always a diversion. Like, it's funny you bring up the umbrella, right? So he sets up an expectation. The first time, I think the first two times you see it, it opens, right?
Yeah.
And then, yes. But I feel like the third time it's landed on, you're waiting for it to open.
Yes.
It doesn't.
Yes.
So he's...
And that's also sort of the moment when he gets caught.
Right.
Yes, yes, yes.
So he's subverting you, but at the same time changing things at the same time. So it becomes this circle. So it's like, I understand that you want everybody to understand what's happening, but you understand you're giving us a lot. And in a way, I think we do. I think the frustration is we can't articulate it. And I think that's hard. I think that's hard for people. And to accept if I can't articulate something, then that means I can't understand it. And that's not necessarily true.
Right.
I mean, these are some of the most immersive films that he made ever. You know, Crucially in My Car in particular. And it feels like I'm watching something beyond a film, you know, like you're so caught up in it. Like, and it goes sort of contrary to kind of established rules of making cinema immersive. You know, for instance, the look into camera that's characteristic of Garman's films. It's like, oh no, you're not supposed to have the actors look into camera. That breaks the illusion that you're like, no, the fact that you have people looking into the camera makes it more real. It feels like this camera is really in the time period filming people for real. Or, you know, same with how choreographed everything is. It sort of takes a while to actually even realize how elaborate the choreography for each shot is, you know, because that's you sort of take it for granted, like the camera is just following along as if this is really happening, you know, but it's not the sort of random shaking camera or the sort of static long takes, you know, that a lot of other filmmakers have worked with. It's completely its own thing, so it's really hard to kind of apply it to the rules of established cinema when you get such a strong effect that, you know, is contrary to what you'd expect.
Yes. You know, I have to ask you guys something, because in the booklet that came with, I mean, it's a wonderful Arrow edition, but this article that is in the booklet, the first one, has some things in it. I'm like, I don't know about this. So, you know, I wanted to ask you guys. Like, for instance, when I saw it at the New York Film Festival, it did not have any narration.
It didn't.
And it did not.
Yeah, you mentioned that to me before, and I thought that was really surprising, because, like, there's not a lot of narration, but the narration feels so key, and, like, all of Garman's films have at least some kind of, you know, either narration or, like, some character kind of narrating over a particular part. So, like, if... I don't know. I know because his films had such a long production and post-production, if it's maybe something that just wasn't finalized yet. Like, the sound design for the film is really elaborate. Yes. Yeah, it's really something. So it might just have not been
now,
ready in time
for the
festival.
Now, I have to tell you, though,
but
one of the only things I remember, but I can't tell you that this is 100% a real memory. I wish there was a recording. But I could swear that Garman, in that question and answer, admitted that he's going to now put narration in to help people along to understand more what's going on.
I can see that. I could see that, and especially in the sense of making sense of the sun, and his and
yes, and, sure. And that's what I wanted to ask you.
It's interesting. Like, the narration's not there to explain the events that are happening. It's there to actually sort of explain the relationship between the son and the father.
Right.
Yes. You know, that's the kind of important part of that narration. And I know Garman talked a lot about how, you know, so much of the film is autobiographical, kind of pulling elements from his own life. And to me, it sort of feels like Klensky and Son are kind of both semi-autobiographical characters. And Garman talked a lot about, you know, growing up in this sort of privileged household where his father was a famous author and he was actually sort of insulated from a lot of the awfulness of the society he was in. And it took him a while growing up to kind of realize that. And, you know, he's not, you know, of course, he said he never reported on his father or anything like that. But I think in a way, the film is sort of saying that he could have, and it's sort of trying to understand, you know, that the child and the father, that there's something in both of these people that's connected very deeply and how different they are. You know, like, there's one part where, you know, the kids are playing in the schoolyard spouting this sort of anti-Semitic, anti-Zionist kind of propaganda. And, you know, when the father, Klensky, hears it coming out of his son and he just hits him. Like, I don't, you know, advocate hitting kids, but I always get a kick out of just like how he smacks his son, you know, because like he's Jewish actually. Like, and it's just, you know, the son's sort of spouting off propaganda. And like, to me, on some level, it felt almost like, you know, Garman maybe remembering something embarrassing he might've repeated as a kid and kind of wish he can go back and smack himself. Right. Like, that was almost the feeling I got from that.
Interesting. Yeah.
The kid felt so personal. You know, when I watched it the first time, and I knew very little about the history of the film, anything. I did not read anything about it, actually, except maybe the logline blurb. I watched The Son, and I said, this son, I said, I wondered if this was like about him and his father, because it felt very personal. And those were usually the moments that actually felt of the film that felt the most grounded. Maybe that's the wrong word, but that felt the most connected to him in an interesting way. So when you're saying this, I was like, I can feel all of that. Right. So when those moments would happen, it actually felt that way as I was watching it.
I mean, the other thing that's interesting to me, too, is how different Klensky is from the main character of Garman's previous film, My Friend Ivan Lapshin, which is the beginning of the Stalinist era. And it's sort of like, OK, you know, they're each a man from their time period and they're separated by about 20 years. And like, they're just completely different people built for surviving different things, or in some, you know, in Ivan Lapshin's case, not surviving. You know, he's sort of a doomed man who's very idealistic and romantic about the future of communism and Stalin, and it's sort of right on the cusp of this big purge. And, you know, knowing that Ivan Lapshin was a character created by his father, and, you know, the actor cast looks, I think, a lot like Garman's father, and, you know, Alexei Garman's depiction of Ivan Lapshin is very loving, but I think he's also a very kind of weak character in a certain way. You know, he's somebody who has this romantic notion that when it's dispelled, he lashes out very violently. Mm-hmm. You know, it personalizes that political stuff by, you know, having him rejected by this woman who's in love with, played by Nina Ruslanova, who also shows up in Krusty L.A. My Car. So it's like, you know, and the rejection manifests itself in him kind of acting like a cold-blooded killer later in the film. You know, this idea that Ivan Lapshin's never going to have the sort of paradise that he wants, never going to have the woman that he wants. And then you contrast that with General Klensky, who's married to the woman that Ivan Lapshin was like hiding for. And he's kind of like neglectful of her. Yeah. He's cheating on her. And, you know, like, it seems very deliberate, that kind of casting of Nina Ruslanova again in this particular role, and just to contrast these two men. And like, Klensky is such a not a romantic person. He's so you know, like, he's not actually that endearing of a character, but he's like somebody who's really just built to survive this era, this regime. You know, I think of all the balancing acts.
He's a circus character. Literally, and it's like, and I thought about that watching it recently this morning. I said, is that the only kind of person who could actually survive in this society? The totally adaptable.
Well, yeah, because it's a tightrope walk. Exactly. Like, the whole society is walking on a tightrope. Exactly. You know, and not that he survives to the end, but that he's kind of put through the ringer, and he comes out at the end, like, scathed, but he's alive. Like, yeah. That's kind of the thing with Glinsky is, you know, I just looking at the actor, Yuri Cirillo, like, he looks like somebody could shove into a meat grinder and he would come out, like a little worse for wear, but he'd be okay. Like, he'd be fine. Like, I heard how he got cast. Like, he was a blacksmith working in provincial theater for like 20 years, and he had like little bit parts in films and stuff, but he was not at all famous when he was cast. But he was in this play, I think it's called Minutes of the Meeting, the play, and he had gotten to a fight with the director, and he got beat up and bruised. Yes. And then, like, apparently, you know, when he was acting in the play the next day, he put on this fedora to try to cover up all his bruises and things, and that's how he was recognized and cast in this part. And, you know, you see him at the end, and like, that's totally the character, just like bruised and beat up and trying to cover it with his fedora. So it's such a great bit of casting. Like, his physical performance is really incredible. The way, like, sometimes he's the biggest guy in the room, and sometimes he just like shrinks himself down.
It's incredible.
He makes himself tiny. Like, it's really amazing.
And there's this last viewing, there was so much of this very strange hand to nose stuff going on with multiple characters. Did you guys notice this? It was not just simply, you know, getting snot out of your nose with your hand. It was like happening with at least 7 or 8 of the characters over and over and over again, that for some reason I never noticed in quite this way before. It made it seem like there was some other thing going on. Like, does anybody have any idea what that might be?
Maybe it was a gesture thing. I mean, this film...
Yeah, something, you know, like that.
Like a Kurosawa gesture thing. He wanted them to all to have a gesture. I wouldn't put it past the filmmaker. There are so many motifs that you catch in the film that I feel like, maybe after viewing 10, you go, wait a minute, did you see this motif? And being that you've seen it so many times, you probably could catch it now. But I wouldn't doubt something like that. Like, I didn't catch it, but like, I'm sure I'm going to see it now, and I'm going to go, oh, shoot, hell, he's right. Wow, what is that?
And there's one guy that never frightened me before, and he frightens me every time. I'm more frightened of him than any of the guys in the truck. And it's just this guy at this like party, and he's the first guy that really does the nose thing.
Interesting.
And he looks so insane, the way he's looking at him, and he goes to kiss Glinsky, or he puts his arms around him really in this really weird way. And you can almost just watch the movie and just look at these, forget the main people in the frame, look at the other people and try and see their work going on. And it's incredible. It's incredible.
That's
work.
That I love, honestly, the most, when you know, because the camera's constantly finding people, or people are finding the camera. It's so organic, and that's what I love about the movie. It's his filmmaking has an organicity to it that's so grand, which I think is also really interesting. Yeah. I'm like going on another segue, but I'll come back. But if you look at like depictions from America of the Soviets, it's always rigid, unimaginative.
Yes. Yeah.
they go there
like robots. Yeah.
But you watch this film shows it as organic, messy, you know, creative, not creative, bumbling, you know, unorganized or organized. It feels like life, and it's amazing. But the people where they're placed, you're watching the people, you know, within the, especially when he's really utilizing the deep focus really strongly, I'm constantly looking at that person sitting in the back, kind of looking, right?
Yeah.
Or also just keeping my gaze ready, because I know it's possible he's going to flip the camera and you're going to see grandma right there with a little when she closes the door, or maybe that's her mom when he goes visits the woman he's cheating on his wife with. Like, that's incredible. I was like, oh my god,
his old girlfriend.
Like, what? Oh my! And I'm always ready. I'm always looking at like the outskirts of the frame, because I know if he's sitting here too long, we're not staying here very long. Something's going to happen.
No, and sometimes that's where the key details are. I mean, like, German's background, before he started directing films. Like, he was working as a second unit director, and that was his specialty, was working with background extras and choreographing all that stuff. So, like, you can see how he brought that skill into his regular directing style and kind of pushing that sort of detail into the foreground and sort of inverting the usual relationship between, like, oh, you're not really supposed to notice the background actors. Like, here, no, that's the most interesting part sometimes. So, like, that's also part of his style. And, like, just that, you know, the sort of roving camera and making sure that, you know, even the tiniest performance holds up and feels dynamic or does something interesting. Like, there's one part where they're driving in the car and the camera turns and there's a woman in the car that's driving next to them, and she sort of shares this glance and smiles a bit. And it's this incredible moment with somebody who's not really a character. It feels like so spontaneous and organic, like you said. And it's just, you know, this really incredible moment. Like, I mean, his films are full of that, but the Cristelli in My Car in particular feels like overloaded with that. So,
yes. And you know, the back in 95 or whatever, when I saw My Friend Evan Lapshin, it influenced me so much that week. And I was filming my thesis film, and I, when I got on the in the little set there, I told my friend who was shooting it, I said, I want to do this handheld now, not on the sticks. And it was all because of My Friend Evan Lapshin. And then, it turned out the shot really sucked. But whatever. But last week I was shooting something too, and I'm so influenced by this bright light that are in these scenes that are just like very, very focused bright light, like somewhere. It's almost every scene has this glowing bright light that's contained, and. I have not seen anything like this in other movies. They don't have this. It's unrealistic. It's like somehow it's much brighter than any other light in the shot. But sometimes there's multiple ones, but it's usually just one that's there. I don't know what it is about this. So anyway, I have this scene I was doing, and I had this 200-watt bulb, and I brought this little thing, and I'm setting it up for the shot, and the actor's like, Why are you doing this? And I'm like, yeah, what am I doing? Why am I? It doesn't even fit in. I wanted to just have this. These films influence me in a way that other films don't. Like, I'm sure I have influences like that. I'm sure the reasons why I select certain shots are all because of other things. You know, if you can unpack it. But this is so direct. It's so, like, and it's almost embarrassing. Like, I just want to. I want my thing to have these things, you know, aesthetically. it's such an invasion of my aesthetics.
I mean, you see other filmmakers have been influenced by Garman, but it feels so kind of few and far between. You would expect that it would be more frequent. People would be trying to copy this because, like, how do you go back after watching films like these? You know, it's sort of one of those things where you're like, oh, movies are different now once you've seen it. You know, like, I really wondered if Bellatar was influenced by Alexis Garman around the time he did Workmeister Harmonies, because, like, Cristelli in My Car is 1998, Workmeister Harmonies is 2000, and, like, his style changed quite a bit, I think, between, like, Damnation and Satan Tango.
Totally.
Like, there's a bit of camera movement, but it's very, like, you know, linear, moving, you know, panning sideways, moving forwards. When you get to Werkmeister Harmonies, it's like that opening sequence in particular, I thought was really, I don't know, like German-esque.
Totally,
like,
totally.
You know, it feels like it would fit right into Cristelli in My Car. So, like, that was one I could think of. There are filmmakers that tried, like, sort of shamelessly to copy a style that, I think it doesn't work at all.
Well, how about his son? His son?
Well, his son's, I think his, like, first
work.
Two films were, you know, it feels like, I mean, what it reminded me of is like, David Cronenberg's son making a Cronenberg film, and it's like, like, you don't have to, just because it's your father, like, doesn't mean you have to make a film like that. Like, figure out your own way of making a film. Or, you know, it's a little bit like that. Like, I know some of Cassavetti's kids have kind of tried to figure out their own thing. But, you know, like, I mean, There was this film called Confrontation I watched that was like 6 hours long, maybe longer, that was basically like a take off My Friend Ivan Lapshin. And it wasn't nearly as good at all because it felt like so conscious and drawn out. And like, you know, I think there's just a level of skill with Alexei Garman's stuff that's hard to replicate. You know, it's so choreographed, yes. It's so dense that like, you know, trying to copy it, you kind of need to match that level of skill on some level, which, you know, not every filmmaker can.
You'd also have to make it your own. It's so itself, you know.
Yeah.
And like, there's definitely films that I feel like are similar to, you know, Herman's work, you know. But I thought about it, I said, you know, the reason why I feel good comparing them because they're similar, but you see where they're really different because each of these filmmakers have the kind of their own voice. Because I feel like copying this, I agree with you. There's no way you could copy this. You can't. It's coming from his instincts. It's coming from probably a lot of it's coming from his subconscious and his instincts, his feeling, his like, oh, I, you know, have her just come here and move this way. You know, he's going off of, you know, he accumulated all this information and now he's allowed himself to kind of feel his way and create these tapestries. You can't copy that, man. And if you do it, you're going to get really stale stuff.
Right.
Yeah.
Or even just narratively, like I was trying to think of other films to kind of compare it to a little while back when I was writing the articles. Like I thought, you can kind of contrast it with Sukharov's trilogy, like Moloch, Taurus, and The Sun, which...
I thought about Taurus a lot this time when I watched it.
Yeah, like, on some level, like, you know, they're very stylized, and they're both sort of taking this kind of realist, humanist approach to dictators, you know, but, I think Sukharov had like a really specific thesis that he kind of moved in those films with, and, like, he wasn't even really concerned about portraying history accurately. Like those films do kind of deviate from historical facts, but he had this idea that, you know, these dictators aren't really controlling their own regimes, that they're just sort of like empty figureheads for power that's already in motion and the sociological attribution of power. But like, you know, they're not actually humanist films, even though they humanize these figures. They're sociological films, you know. It's sort of a, in a way, it's like an experiment, that trilogy, I think. But Garman's approach, like, he humanizes Stalin by just showing him corporeally. Like, you know, that's where the realism is. It's like, what could be more human than just dying like that, like gurgling and farting? And, you know, that's the human Stalin. And it doesn't, you know, it achieves that humanization without disassociating him from anything else that's around him. It actually puts him in the center, like this sick world, it's coming from this sick man. Like it's all connected. So you know, I find that really powerful. And like, I know other films have tried to do sort of similar things, like I mean, there's the film Downfall about Hitler in the bunker, and it's sort of treating that like this microcosm for Nazi Germany, where it's like at the end all they have left to kill is each other, but kill themselves, you know. But like, that film is not like, it's very conventional in its stylistic approach. You know, it's sort of like a conscious metaphor. Like, Christelli in My Car, it feels like any kind of metaphors you can take about this society, it's like built from the inside out. You know, it's coming from that very internal place. And then all the stuff with identity, like, again, like, you know, this is German's most autobiographical film. So the way it deals with Jewish identity, I found really interesting. Like, a lot of his films have these characters with kind of dual identities, you know. Trial on the Road, it's like a Russian who was fighting in the German side during World War II, or even something like The Fall of Ottar, which he wrote and produced but he didn't direct. It's this Mongol who's also a Muslim trying to save this city basically from Genghis Khan, and he's kind of torn between that two sides. But like, really, Christelli in My Car deals with that identity. Like, Kletsky, he's Jewish and he's Russian. Like, it's not that there's a, you know, difference, like a lot of Russians sort of seem to think that, like, oh, you either are Jewish or you're Russian. And you know, German obviously is both, and the film sort of treats Kletsky as both, and how that falls out with the sort of anti-Semitism of the time, and how it works with that character's identity, I find like really, I know, just raw. Like, you know, it's a theme that's in his other films, but here, it, like, I find it's just closest to the surface and really kind of you know, personal and powerful. And Garman, like, I don't know, just in contrast to Tarkovsky, like, Tarkovsky comes up so much when you're talking about Russian film that it's kind of impossible not to compare them sometimes, you know. And, like, they started off sort of similar. Like, I think if you look at, you know, Ivan's Childhood and Trial on the Road, like, they're actually pretty comparable. Right. And it's just, like, their styles developed in completely different directions. But, like, you know, Tarkovsky, he's so caught up in the sort of Christianity, and then, like, there's sort of more ambiguous spirituality. Yeah. But, like, one thing I always kind of gravitate to for Garman, like, you know, he can make a film like Hard to Be a God, which is the most medieval thing ever, and there's no, you know, like, no Pieta, like in Andrei Rublev, there's no Christian imagery at all. He actually made a medieval world without a Christ, and I don't know, for whatever reason, like, I find it sort of refreshing that his films aren't loaded up with, like, you know, Christian symbolism and like, he sort of creates his own symbols, which I you know, I find, like, both sort of more interesting, and also just I can relate to it a little bit more.
He also seems to have interesting commentary on symbols, because when you talk about the Jewish identity thing, you know, one thing I really appreciated about it was there's this element of marginalized people when they become, when they're no longer human, when they become mythological.
Yes.
So Jewish people in this kind of context are like these myths. They're platitudes, right?
Right. I mean, the whole Doctor's Plot, I should explain maybe for people listening who have no idea what we've been talking about. Like, it was a supposed plot that Stalin said Jewish doctors were conspiring to kill him. So he had them rounded up and sent to a gulag. And of course, this was completely invented. It was a myth, a fiction, you know. So that's where this is all coming from.
And part of the reason why you're able to enact that kind of thing is when you make people into mythology, right? So Jewish people are this mythology. And I remember whenever, like, something about Jewish people would come up in the film, they would be these, like, sayings, right? You know, and I relate to that as a Black person here in America. You know, you realize that, like, you don't exist as a functioning human being. You exist as mythology, right? You exist as a platitude. Mm. Well, the Blacks or the Mexicans.
This archetype, this generalization.
And
I really
and he's making, to for me, at least I read it, as a specific commentary of the loss of a humanity when you're always spoken about as this kind of idea rather than just a human freaking being, right? And that's how you're going to have a plot to go round up a bunch of people. Because I don't know, did either of you see that documentary on Zukowski, the artist?
The Polish artist who's incorporating all these Mesoamerican, trying to construct a Polish mythology.
Yeah,
and his anti-Semitic bent. Yeah,
and he totally went into that. He did this was, I guess, was it a manifesto or a kind of booklet where he kind of talked about, you know, the history of, like, species and beings, and he used Jewish people as a kind of example to show a certain type of being that was grown. And I was like, come on, bruh, come on, man. Like, come on, bruh, you really are turning,
like, a
left
lot of people
on this
bought into that. Totally. Like, it's like Europe, it's even today, you can still find that. I know, just for example, like Alexei Garman Jr.'s film, Electric Clouds, he sort of deals with a lot of the sort of contemporary stuff. And you see, under Putin, there's this kind of return to some of these anti-Semitic values and the kind of blaming stuff on oh, it's like Jewish conspiracy. Right. Like, that exists even to this day. Like, that hasn't gone anywhere. Like, even Balabanov, after he did this documentary from the history of aerostatics in Russia, and, like, Alexei Garman kind of took him under his wing and produced one of his first films, Happy Days, sort of based on the Samuel Beckett story. And long story short, Balabanov, like, he, you know, he was sort of a respected popular filmmaker. A lot of people kind of called him Russia's Tarantino.
Oh, wow.
You know, he started adopting all this, like, nationalistic kind of anti-Semitic stuff, and Garman had to basically sever ties. And there was this really great quote about this. Garman said, like, you know, of this defect particular to bastards, I can no longer ignore, you know, and stopped endorsing him, stopped talking with him. So, like, you know, I think that happened right in the 90s when Balabanov was kind of taking off in popularity, and, you know, that coincides with the time that Garman was making Khrushchev Leave My Car. So I think you know, even though it's set in the past, it was probably on his mind as, you know, something that persisted in Russia.
I'd be really curious, because I don't know this. What is German's place in Russian cinema now, according to people in, according to Russians in Russia? Yeah.
I mean, I feel like every time I talk to somebody Russian and I bring up Alexei German, they're like, oh yeah, of course. Like, it's just like one of those guys who, like, he's just a staple of Russian cinema. Like, I don't know if it's true. What I've been told is that more people would recognize My Friend Ivan Lapshin than, like, any Tarkovsky film over there. Like, it's shown on TV and
it's
regarded as, like,
that doesn't surprise
in some ways the Russian film. Chris Charlie and my car, I think, like, the initial reviews were bad. And then he said as soon as it started playing outside the big cities, more in the country where people actually sort of remembered what life was like during that time, he had, like, incredibly strong responses. And I know, like, he sort of said too that, you know, regular filmgoers sometimes got more out of the film than, you know, film critics or cinephiles actually. Like, I think sometimes his films are like that because, again, like, being a film critic or being a cinephile, you're almost trained to watch a film a certain way, which, you know, I think can be a good thing, having that sort of skill set to break apart certain films. But when you run into something that's not made like other films, it becomes, you know, almost like a negative thing, like, oh, this isn't what movies are supposed to be like, that therefore it's bad, you know. And then I think somebody who's not inundated with that stuff, they can actually engage with it, you know. Like, I know some people who aren't, like, big cinephiles, and I'll show them, like, a Bellatar film. They're like, oh, yeah, that's fantastic.
I think it's also because of the people they captured, too. Like, you said, Tar, German.
The ordinariest of the people.
They're the people we don't see on films. You know, you're watching a lot of these popular films or films that, you know, art house communities love, and a lot of times they're either, you know, these aristocratic or very bourgeois people, or bourgeois people playing very poor people in a very bourgeois kind of, like, framework. And, you know, that's why I think I'm a big Tar fan, and I think it's why I got into Tar. I was like, ooh, these are, like, people that I know. And it's interesting watching Krystalia Off My Car. I said, you know, I've never been to Russia. I've only watched a lot of Russian films, and I've read a lot of Russian literature. But I have to say, those packed family housing things reminded me of life that I knew.
Yeah.
The way the arguments are going circular. Everyone, this person's arguing with that one. The kids are messing with, like, the two girls who mess with the son. I was like,
the way they pick on him, just, like, instantly reminds me of, like, how girls used to pick on.
I said that to my girlfriend. I said, you know what? I said, I have to be honest. I used to get weirdly picked on when I was a little kid by my older female cousins, and, like, they did things that were quite inappropriate, like inappropriate that I will not mention on this podcast. I was like, it, but that's why I think if you show people films like these, who are not cinephile type people, they're gonna see things that are relatable to them.
One of the things I thought was just totally outlandish when I was reading about it was that, like, supposedly it got kind of close to being an American co-production.
That's why.
And, like, which, you know, there were going to be certain American actors, or at least Dustin, like, international Hoffman. Actors. Dustin Hoffman was mentioned. Gerard Depardieu, John Malkovich, you know, were all names that kind of came up.
Could you imagine?
I don't know who they would have been playing. I think I heard on the commentary that Dustin Hoffman might have been the Finnish character.
Oh, really interesting.
But, like, I don't know. I just think of that, like, the 1992 Stalin film with Robert Duvall under all that makeup.
Oh, my,
like,
gosh. How awful that is.
But, you know, like, I think, like, in some ways, that you sort of talk about, like, it might have been tantalizing, like, American money and American stuff, but you just can't imagine German compromising on anything. And I know the two big compromises, like, one was that it had to have American actors, and the other was that it had to be in English. Mm. And I don't know, like, how the film, if it would just fall apart, that feeling of total reality. Like,
they dodged a bullet. I'm
really
sorry.
Imagine, like,
they dodged a big bullet. I'm sorry.
Like, I don't know if he ever would have actually, like, you know, he might have entertained the idea, but I don't know if he ever seriously would have done it that way. Like, I think, you know, probably in the back of his head, he was always going to do it his way, and that was it. You know, that's how we worked.
But speaking of this, and I didn't think about this until I read your piece, Martin, which is that a dubbed version of this, though, which is usually like
it's usually
verboten for me.
Right.
You know, I can't stand the idea of that. But because there's so much going on, like, I feel like I'm not fully taking it in
just by reading the subtitles. Yeah.
Just reading the subtitles, and there's so much that's not, you know. If someone could do it right, and because it feels like, you know, so much of it is already overdubbed in Russian. I mean, like, you know, nothing's lining up anyway. It's not like we're suffering from having it not synced.
I mean, it would have to be really
something
good, like
might
something that
happen.
Could actually replicate that sophisticated, elaborate sound design where you have voices coming in and out, music coming in and out, strange sound effects that are very distinct. Yes. Like, I think you would have to kind of go back and basically make a whole new proper sound design from scratch. And, you know, like, I think in some ways that would just better represent for English speaking audiences how the film is. But like, dubbing, it's such a, I mean, not to call it like a lost art form or anything, but like, it's worse now than it ever has been. I think.
Yeah. Are there,
you know,
great
like
English dub actors? Like, are there really are? I'm asking.
Well,
this honestly.
I know, like, you know, just I was listening to Czech radio the other day, and there was a piece on film dubbing. How, like, you know, back in the '60s, they used to take a whole month to dub a film and do it really properly and figure out, like, you know, okay, like, you know, we can't use this word because it won't fit as well. Let's use this word and, like, really think through it. And now, like, okay, you have 3 days to dub this whole film before we stick it on TV. Like, it's become so rushed that you can't do a good job no matter what. So I think, like, you know, there used to be sort of proper dubbed versions of films. Yeah. I'm just finishing up this new article I've been writing about a classic Argentine film, and they talked about how it had to be dubbed, you know, so that they could get rid of the South American accents were so thick that European Spanish speakers couldn't hear it, so they had to redo a whole dub, and how that kind of lost a lot of the poetry of the original dialogue. Like, the screenwriter was also a poet and had, like, a very distinctive quality to it that was completely lost for most European audiences, even when they were watching the Spanish version. So it's really, really hard to do a good dub. But, like, and I always think, like, Grischelli of My Car, for me, you know, it's almost like a Russian, at least sonically, like, it's like on the same wavelength as something like Nashville, where you have voices overlapping and music coming in and out. And, like, you know, if somebody said, okay, here's Nashville, dub it into Russian, like, it's almost an impossible task, you know? It's so daunting. It would have to be, like, a huge endeavor if you really wanted to dub it. But I think, like, hypothetically, that's how I would try to approach getting it across to American audiences or English-speaking audiences, because otherwise, you know, the subtitles, like, it can be sort of nonsensical when you have, like, a piece of dialogue or information that kind of comes in and another piece that overlaps it and stuff kind of fading in and out. But when you're reading the text, it all kind of has the same emphasis. You know, like, I think a little bit it's sort of, you lose a lot of the effect when you're just reading the text. So,
yeah.
I don't know. Are there any other films you think you might compare this to, or anything you wanted to connect it to?
Well, you know, I did. I said this to you before, Martin. Too. They're not the same, but there's something interesting. I also thought about the films of Glober Rocha a lot with the choreography, especially his films like. Lenin, English and Transterth, The Lion Has Seven Heads, and Antonio das Muertes. Like, it's interesting because they go for these kind of choreography moments of the actors. They both do it very differently. And it's kind of circular world a lot of the time.
I like that. I like that Glober Rocha and Alexis Garmendia, like, Glober Rocha sometimes gets called the Orson Welles of Brazilian cinema, and then Alexis Garman sometimes gets called the Orson Welles of Russian cinema. So they both
it's interesting because describing how you see Garman is treated in Russia, it's very similar to how Rocha is in Brazil. His films are not restored. They're impossible to find. But if you talk to somebody about Black God, White Devil, they're like, oh yeah, Glober Rocha, man. That's the man. He's the man. He's the man. He's
and
the
also, man. And, like, their stylistic continuum, like, I always think, like, La Barocha, each film sort of became more and more fragmentary and kind of leaving behind the sort of typical editing, and kind of, he just got more and more himself, you know, and it's sort of the same German, where, like, every film he just pushed his style further and further until, like, it leaves behind everything else.
I watched Black God, White Devil and Antonio Dos Muertes in the same day recently, right? And I hadn't seen Black God, White Devil in a while, and it's actually pretty regular how it's put together compared to Antonio Dos Muertes. Yeah. You're like, whoa, what is he doing? This guy is going wild. And I saw The Lion Has Seven Heads at Metrograph, and that film is all over the place.
They're working with these, like, big, like, you know, getting French money coming in, and then, like, shooting it over, like, bits and pieces over years sometimes. Some of their films, they're both kind of like that in just in the process, even.
Yeah. Yeah. I even thought about the Hourglass Sanatorium, the constant movement of everything and things kind of moving into the next. You know, that's a bit more of a psychedelic acid trip type film for me, but they have their differences. But I did think about that also, this kind of just the organic movement in film and creating this kind of world that's like constantly feels like it's evolving, rather than you're going to the next scene and you're going to the next scene, you're going to the next scene. Yeah. This is an evolving world, and it's amazing to me, and it's as an educator, like, I try to get people to watch these films. Like, I try to push on a student to watch Cristoli of My Car. I don't know if he's watched it over the summer yet. I'll find it out in September. Hopefully he did. And hopefully he doesn't hate me. Hopefully he loves it.
That's great.
Going back to Tar just for a second, one of the things that I was thinking about watching this last time was this idea that Tar has with Agnes, I think.
Kranitsky,
wife. I think she edits it too. Edits the films, but there she is on the set apparently with a stopwatch, and the shots, the long shots, like, she's timing them, and because, you know, the editing is so simple.
I mean, how I had it described to me, like, their relationship, like, eventually she started off as his editor and then kind of moved up to co-director, and how that kind of fits in, like, what she does on set is basically the editing in the camera. That's why she has that co-director credit on all the later films, because he kind of left behind conventional editing. But, like, really, I mean, like Garman's films, like, you know, that I think it's such a great example, that opening scene of Werkmeister Harmonies, because there's close-up, wide-shot, two-shot, you know, reverse shot, and it's all done in a single take, you know, so it's edited, it's paced, and I think that's why it doesn't feel boring or anything like that, you know, like, if you actually said, like, okay, there's a film with a bunch of, like, shots this long, you'd think, like, you know, what could that possibly be of, but it's so rich, and, you know, it still follows a cinematic grammar, it's just, you know, she's making sure that it's all done within the camera.
Yeah, editing is not always where you say cut. I tell this to my students all the time. Editing, I think especially here in the U.S., I think it's really been driven into them that editing means cut and splice. Yeah. I'm like, no, it's not. Like, that's a very postmodern way of thinking about anything, really.
Yes, and I feel like with this film particularly, Crucible of My Car, there it feels like there is that kind of I'd love to time out the shots one day, because I think that there is some kind of method to the madness of this with the timing, because I feel like I know when it's going to cut, it's just in my body somehow, you know, and it felt the same way with Tar, especially with Werkmeister Harmonies. It's a similar thing. Like, it's somehow, I think he's working it into some kind of other rhythm.
It establishes its own rhythm, you know? And even if you don't consciously know what it is, you can sort of just pick up on it. Like, again, these are films that you really feel more than anything. Like, it might not even be precise. Like, if you did time it out, it might not look that systematic, but, like, definitely there's a right feel to it, and everything feels felt out, you know, maybe as much as it is thought out.
And in particular, if people are listening and they want to, and they have the Blu-ray or whatever, and they want to go back, when we first see Klinsky, the motions of the shot before we actually see him, it all feels like it's timed out. We're seeing things, and then he's presented. He's kneeling down. He's got that big bright light, white light on him. It feels like it's like a series of like little movements, and I mean that in a musical way, like that happen, not just movement of the camera, but it feels like there's slight little vignettes that happen, and then we see him. It feels very like all paced out to present him to us. So, something I never saw that in the many times I saw it before.
I always thought it was a little bit funny that during the Stalinist era, by far the most popular genre of film was the musical. There were a whole bunch of these Russian musicals. Yeah. Like, people always think, like, oh, Russian cinema at that time, it must all be these, like, militaristic propaganda films. But really, it was full of these kind of musical comedies and, you know, even color films. But, like, I know, I think Daniel Bird sort of pointed out that the whole scene in the hospital where he's kind of humming and he has his little entourage following is sort of a parody of like the Stalinist era musical, like the workplace
the
musical.
Soft shoe dance, bro. I love that. I laugh out loud every time. You know,
but
I
the whole thing has this kind of musical quality to it, like the way, like, you know, I feel like, you know, at times it's almost like a music video where they just like pulled out the, or like where the music is the dialogue and the sound effects, and it's just kind of this sort of rhythmic thing that you get caught up in. And I always think it's sort of surprising that, like, when you see German's films kind of advertised, like the trailers for Hard to Be a God, they're using the music from Boris Godunov, like this sort of classical operatic type stuff. Same with Christelli and My Car. And like, German didn't really use classical music at all. Like, it's all like contemporary kind of like jazzy stuff or folk music, you know. Like, one of my favorite uses of music is in the film is the Tumbalalaika near the end, the Jewish folk song. That's kind of where you see Klinsky leave the official story, and then you see him again at the epilogue, but that's kind of where he, you know, disappears into the mist, and it's this sort of you know, very kind of profound moment. But, you know, his use of music, I think, like, people, I don't know, like, again, if, you know, you sort of think, like, okay, like, Tarkovsky using classical music, if you have to kind of put him in that same box, but, like, really his films, they have this sort of, you know, contemporary music rhythm to them more than anything, like, that kind of atonal or jazz kind of music, they have that feel to them sometimes.
I have a snobbish appreciation for filmmakers that don't use music easily to stimulate my emotions, you know.
I mean I
feel like it's almost a snobbish thing, but any time that happens, it feels like it's, you know, that's true cinema to me, you know.
Right. I mean, like, on some level, you know, you can put Ode to Joy under any piece of film and a person will be moved by it because they're not responding to the images, they're responding to the music, you know. So, like, in a way, it's a little bit of a cheat.
You got to find a way to weave the music in a real way that's not just, all right, this scene doesn't have enough power.
Yes.
Throw a track under it.
Right. That's part of the magic of the sound design for these films is, you sort of wonder, like, am I really hearing that? Like, is there something just off screen? And it kind of helps shape the world around just this tiny little box that you're seeing in. Like, you kind of feel like something exists outside of that and beyond that. And I feel like that kind of goes hand in hand with the glancing into camera, or people talking into camera. You sort of feel like you're surrounded in a way by the film. It goes beyond just the visual. You know, you hear sounds and you hear people talking. Like, I'm pretty sure you hear characters talk in the film that you never see. You know, there's people talking at points where, like, you know, I think, like, again, like, just the way people are trained to make films, it's like, oh, there's a cow on screen, the cow should go moo. Like, there's that kind of thought process. And German sort of breaks that. He talks about, you know, when he was first editing Trial on the Road, kind of figuring out his own style, saying, when people were talking, it was like shot, reverse shot. He said it was very boring, and he sort of stumbled into realizing that, like, hey, you know, this scene starts to get interesting when the close-up is on the person listening, not the one talking. And, you know, kind of trying to rethink the relationship between the sounds and the images in a way that I think is very, I don't know, just like outside the norm and compelling.
I couldn't agree with him more. I mean, it's even something I appreciate with about Tarkovsky, that he would have the willingness to, like, you know, have a whole conversation and you don't see the other person. And it's just like, come on, man. It's something that I and maybe this is a negative or not a real take, but I feel like non-American filmmakers have a lot of times a bit more of a willingness to do that. Here in the U.S., there is such a premium on the person who is speaking. You have to see them. But I'm like, the reaction is sometimes even more important, you know? You know, like or something like Raise the Red Lantern, where you never see the guy who runs the whole place. But he lives in the – or you never see him fully. I don't think you ever actually get a close-up of his face. He's always in the distance. And I say that says more thematically about his position in the world and their position to him than any close-up you could have ever made and any line you could have written about him.
Yes. I mean, sometimes, you know, by obscuring things, you actually get more out of them. I think it's something that American cinema doesn't always get. Like, German's films, I forget if I've said this before on some other show, but, like, it's hard to get a good screenshot from them because there's so much moving in the foreground. A lot of the close-ups, like, you know, you have an out of focus bald head covering like 90% of the frame. It's not these, like, I don't know if you know on Twitter, like the one perfect shot, and it's always this like symmetrical looking, like, you know, Wes Anderson type shots, which, like, that can be fine too. But, like, German's approach, you know, he actually sort of blocks off and obscures a lot of what you're seeing. Like, you know, his framing to me always feels like it's like a little bit too tight to breathe, which I like actually. Like, and you know, he kind of pushes that even more with Hard to Be a God, I think, where, like, you know, most of the film is in close-up basically. It's sort of uncomfortable actually, and I don't know, I think, like, it would be contrary to what something like Chris Jelly of My Car is about to have too much aesthetic visual pleasure in the film. He has to kind of invent his own aesthetics to properly express what's going on, you know. It's like, I think that's part of the reason why he doesn't use color really. Like, it's just, you know, something about it would be dishonest.
Yes, and it makes me, I mean, every time I see, like, any of the trailers for any of this, like, I don't, or like you said, disembodied shots, I always feel like it's blasphemous. Like, we, like, something's wrong. Like, you can't just take this and put it out there. Right. Like, and also, almost, I mean, Martin, I'm not just blowing smoke up your ass here. Your piece is the only thing that I feel that I've read about him that I didn't get mad. I didn't want people talking, like, writing about him. They're not getting it. You're not getting it.
I know, you know what you mean.
It shouldn't be talked about. Just see it, and then don't talk about it afterward either.
Well, I'm glad we're having this conversation about it, at least.
You know what? And you know what's weird about this conversation is, I mean, and I really mean this, the way you guys were talking, and I didn't think this would be possible, it makes me want to watch it again right now, and I didn't think I would have that. I thought I was over this for a little while.
That's the other thing that, like, frustrates the hell out of me, too, is talking to people about, like, Hard to Be a God and Chris Jelly in My Car. Like, some people will be like, man, Hard to Be a God, that was such a hard watch. Like, I'm never watching that again, or can't watch that. Like, off. Like, I could put it on again right now. Like, it's something about it is so easy to settle into. Like, as, you know, shocking as the images are and kind of abrasive as a lot of the content is, like, it's such an easy watch, I find. You know, and it's hard to explain that to people.
I mean, I know.
It's funny. It's like, it's even just, like, aside from, like, the sense of humor, like, there's a sort of, I don't know, again, like, comparing it to music, it's like putting on a great piece of blues music that, like, maybe it's talking about something sad or ugly, but it's so sort of on some level soothing, and you can kind of just fall back into it very, very easily.
Yes.
Yeah, I totally agree.
Yeah. So I feel like we covered a lot of ground. I don't know if there's anything you guys wanted to mention that we didn't cover, or if you're feeling pretty good about this.
Well, I want to say, I wish I said this in the beginning. If anybody's tuning, just like found this podcast because they found, they searched for this movie's title, and they just wanted to hear people talk about it, and the and because they're baffled by it, they're confused. I just want to say to them, like, just relax. Like, we don't fully get it either. Like, nobody, like I don't know of anybody that totally understands every single motivation for every single thing that happens in this movie.
I mean, the characters don't.
Confusion is okay.
Right. Confusion, it's okay to be confused. You're in good hands. Like, it's fine.
Yeah. Yeah. And just the idea of taking it in and seeing it again, and just go back and see it again. Don't go searching too much, trying to find what other people think about it, because that hasn't been very helpful for me. What's been helpful for me is just watching it again. Like, I wish people had my experience with it, which was seeing it many times and having no one to talk to about it, and just having to see it again.
It made me really happy when you reached out, because I'm like, oh, like, it's not just me.
yeah. And I think that it's hard to get that these days, because you want to hear what someone else has to say about it. And sometimes that's good after a certain point, but watch it again and feel how you feel about it, and see how these, you know. And I just feel like this is a master, like the idea that this film exists, and whatever struggles he went through to make this thing. I feel like, I'm sorry he went through that, but, oh man, I'm glad he did. This. And yeah. I'm glad he was the most stubborn filmmaker of the century or whatever. Thank you.
You really get the feeling like he just couldn't put a dishonest frame on film. Like, it was just against his nature, you know.
Yeah.
I know Svetlana Kamerlita had this great anecdote about working on Hard to Be a God, where, you know, they had everything set up, choreographed, and then, like, he refused to film. Like, he just couldn't, something was wrong. You know, and they were sort of bugging him, and she bugged him, and, like, he just wouldn't film. He kept thinking and trying to decide, and they used up a whole day without any shooting, and then they used up a whole second day, I think, of not shooting, and, like, he just refused to shoot, and finally he decided, like, okay, what we need, go and buy me a whole bunch of flowers. And they scatter the flowers in the scene because, like, you know, in medieval times, people would, you know, try to use it to cover up the smell that was everywhere in medieval Europe. And, you know, you see the characters carrying flowers in the scene, and it's perfect. And, you know, it's just like he needed that extra thing, and he couldn't shoot it until, you know, I can get why, like, on set, that would be incredibly frustrating to see a filmmaker kind of like... You know, she was saying, like, well, just shoot something. You could always reshoot it after. And, like, he just couldn't, you know. That's who he was. It's like...
But you hear these stories of the great masters. Like, you hear a similar story with Cassavetes, mm-hmm. with Seymour Cassell. Like, he told Cassell, go home over the course of 2 days. Did not film with him at all until finally, like, he came back and he realized Cassell had something right. Mm-hmm. You know, and, like, just the idea, like, this is what masters do. Something's not right.
It's like they're not getting it. We got to sit down with the actors and just talk about these characters for a couple of days. So you guys just go home.
Yeah.
Crew, you're not working for 2 days. Come back on Thursday.
Yeah.
And it's on Tuesday, you know, and it's like... I feel we could get into a longer conversation of how film has become this kind of super schedule oriented type of art form.
I mean, time is such a big factor in, I think, like, again, sorry to keep picking on Hollywood films, but, like, I think there's this misunderstanding that, like, a lot of money makes a great film, when really I think a lot of time is more important. Like,
I agree.
I was just going through, like, John Carpenter's films the other day for fun, and, like, The Thing for me is such a clear standout. And then when you read up on why The Thing turned out the way it did, it's like, okay, it had a really long pre-production. It had a period of time in between, you know, shooting the exteriors and interiors where you could go and kind of, you know, figure out what was working, what wasn't, rewrite certain things. He had, like, an unusually long amount of time to work on this film. And I think, like, that's sort of the key factor in why I think that's his best film, you know. Like, I think, I mean, you know, you can make a great film that's done very quickly and spontaneously. But, you know, really, I think time is such a huge asset that's undervalued in making a great work of film. I mean, some people sort of, I think, fetishize the sort of production aspects, the time aspects. Like, have you heard about this film, Dao, that's finally mm-hmm. coming out?
No.
This, like, okay, Kurchanovsky, this young Russian filmmaker, has been working on this movie called Dao for, like, several years at this point, where there were a bunch of articles written about it, where he created this, like, functional Stalinist era city and populated it with extras and set up, like, 100 cameras.
Oh, wow.
And he would film people as if, like, it was really the time period. Like, actors wouldn't stop acting. They would live as if they were in the 1950s or 60s. Might not have been Stalinist. It might have been after, because it's about Lev Landau, the scientist. But it's, like, you know, he shot for years and years, and, like, every person was costumed, and they would, you know, wake up, go to work, and just be filmed in that time period. And, like, I think it's the kind of thing where, okay, if the movie's a masterpiece, then he's a genius. But otherwise, I think it's just kind of production for the sake of production. And, you know, like, I have serious doubts that any of that is going to translate to the final film. Or I guess now he's saying it's a series of films. He collected so much footage that it's going to be like a whole bunch of films. But, you know, like, on one hand, that's sort of an interesting experiment, but, like, that's not what German was doing. Like, you know, in some ways, the production was actually pretty small scale. You look at the crew he had, it's not that big. He sort of shot steadily over a long period of time and took a long time to choreograph, but it's not like there was a lot of waste either.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, yeah.
So, I mean, you know, the most famous shutdown on production was for the cars that you see, like, those period cars, which I think, like, that's an important detail. It's sort of this motif it keeps coming back to. Like, I always think it's like a school of sharks at nighttime, you know, these cars driving.
I said, how did he get this done? I was like, how did he get this happen?
Those are the real, like, he bought and restored, you know, the cars you're seeing in the film. And, like, they're the real cars that NKVD drove. Like, I know the Czech versions, like the Tatra 603, the like, communist elite. I'm not sure what the Russian one was, but, like, those were the cars that the people in the film drove. You know, like, a Hollywood film, you could kind of do a mock-up, but probably for his film, like, yeah, it might have taken longer, but it was probably cheaper. Because, like, really, I think at the end, even with all the production delays and everything, the final budget in American dollars would have been less than $2 million.
Jeez.
And then, you know, which, like, I think, you know, by being selective about what you're seeing, you know, with this sort of obscured frame and the sound design, everything, you really get a feeling that this world is, you know, a real world, and it's fully developed, and you're just seeing a small piece of it. But really, like, film, it's an illusion. Like, I remember Bill Pope talking about shooting Army of Darkness, which is, you know, maybe not the best example, but he sort of said, like, you know, there was the shot had to be exactly as wide as it was, because any wider and you would see that it was just a phony set. So, you know, I think, like, Cristiano Macari probably was like that a little bit to some extent, where, like, yeah, if it was any wider, you could see that the illusion would start to fall apart, but it's perfect. And I think that's where the mastery comes into it.
Yes. Yes.
Mm.
Yeah. So, I guess that probably covers it, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, I could talk about this stuff forever.
I know. I'm so glad we had this. Like, this is sort of this is one of those films I won't shut up about.
Yes.
I did want to say one last thing. You know, it was great hearing your relationship with it, Peter, because, you know, I try to think about certain works of art as having an ongoing relationship with it. And I think that's very important, I think, with this film. So kind of like to echo what you said about people who say have found this film and they find it confusing or confounding. Like I said, I'm kind of similar. I read things, except for I read Martin's piece straight through. But other things, I kind of stop reading halfway through. I don't really get that interested in it. It's not that interesting. Even the booklet I didn't finish, to be honest with you. I plan on doing it, but I wasn't invigorated to do it. But I love talking about it. with people who have seen it. Yes. I really, because that to me is about the relationship of the film, because it does feel more like an emotional experience for me. It's something that kind of lives in me, and then the images are kind of, and there's images and motifs that are stained. So I'm saying, for people who do watch it, accept your relationship with this film, because it's going to go on for a long time. And, well,
like,
and you'll
this conversation, like, I'm going to be taking this in next time I watch it. Like, you know, this conversation is going to add something to the next time I watch the film, you know, so I really value it. And thank you both for coming on. Like, this has been really great.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, what a pleasure.
Total pleasure.
Absolute pleasure.
So, Peter, if folks want to find you online, where can they look?
Yes, well, I'm on Twitter at Peter_Rinaldi. And the podcast is Back to One, and they can find it in everywhere they get podcasts, or at the Filmmaker Magazine website. And it's every week I interview another actor.
Really fantastic interviewer, I think.
I appreciate that, man. Yeah.
Just saying, I think you are. It's really good. I think anyone listening to this should definitely subscribe to the podcast.
I've learned more about acting from this thing than in my entire life, just talking to these people. It's been like a real learning experience for me. Really. That's where my passion is coming from, because I'm learning, you know, from these people. So I appreciate that, man. Find me there, and also I have a couple films coming out, short films I'm working on all at one time, but I'll tell more about that when I can actually, you know, when I can actually form them into a way to talk about them. Yeah.
Cool. And M2May, is there anywhere people can find you online and stuff coming up?
You could find me on Twitter at Sir Corgant, SirCoreGant. I have a website, altereyecinema.com. It's alter and like I, like the I in your head, and cinema.com. I'm literally in pre-production for my first feature film right now. I'm starting on a long road with that. So hopefully sometime, I think hopefully next year, people will start hearing more things about it coming about. And I have a couple films online, two films of mine, White Face and Spit. You can shoot shorts I did, and you can check out there. And find me. I hop on podcasts here, you know, when I can. So, you know, you can find me out there talking smack about movies and various things.
I just heard you over on the We Cut Heads podcast.
Yes, a good appearance. Yeah.
I spent the whole time feeling guilty that, like, I couldn't get the podcast together with you before. I felt really bad about that, because, like, it was like I kept getting busy right when I thought it could happen, and then eventually I was like, oh no, I didn't follow up. So I felt really bad about that. But
we got.
Thank you for coming on this. So I'm really, really happy. Thank you for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
Cool. And if folks want to check out more of the show, just go to flixwise.com. Lots of great episodes. I'm at Movie Kessler on Twitter. And until next time, listeners, take care. Размышлял и спать не мог, как бы жениться, чтоб не стыдиться, как бы жениться мне поскорей. Тумбала, 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 лайка, тумбала, 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 лайка. Ну-ка сыграй-ка, тумбала, лайка, ну-ка сыграй-ка повеселей. Шарки открывать и нашлись.